Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Judge Kevin G. Ross presiding. This is case A210109, Kevin Kopka et al. Appellants versus Sand Hospitality LLC, respondent.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this single oral argument for this August 12 panel. My apologies to counsel. We had some technological difficulties. We had technological difficulties. I had technological difficulties slowing us down this morning, so I'm sorry we're about 8 minutes late starting. But I will just remind you of our rules for the sake of the oral argument. Of course, we can see each other now by our Zoom platform, but we only keep an audio recording of the argument today. So please follow our customary procedure by stating your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of the audio recording. Appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And of course, respondent's counsel will have 15 minutes in total. Counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, appellant's counsel, you have the floor.
Great, thank you. I'm Michael Bryant. I represent the Kopkas, the appellants in this case. First, I want to thank the court for moving the last date because of my knee surgery that I had. So I don't have a lot to add to the written part of the materials. What the key to me, or I would submit as the key, is the court's finding as to a duty, the court's finding as to what took place, and then coming to a conclusion that there was no proximate cause between the injury and what happened. The facts clearly indicate that they would not have had to have the injection, or they would not have had to have the shots. They wouldn't have had the false positive on the HIV, except for what happened. The incident took place. The court accepted that as taking place the way that it was submitted by the plaintiff, and still came to the conclusion that there wasn't a connection between the damages that resulted. Both of these minor children were damaged because of what they had to go through and what they continue to go through. And I would submit that that's even supported by the expert that was submitted by the respondent. The response goes back and argues some things that were already found by the court, which is the issue as far as a duty goes. Second, they also seem to argue that, well, because these are minor children, they don't remember. And I'd submit that that isn't the position in Minnesota. If we went with just with minor children and you didn't remember, there were lots of cases that would be tough.
Can I throw out what I think, sure. at least for me, is a bit of a sticking point, just so you can address it directly. I'm concerned about the attenuated relationship between the alleged breach and the injury suffered. There's plenty of case law that sort of sets out a mosaic, a series of cases that seem to have enough facts to get past summary judgment, and a number of cases that don't. Can you explain why it is that you believe this case, the injury in this case, is not too far attenuated from the breach to get around summary judgment?
Well, the first argument I would make is that goes more towards the weight, and that something should be evaluated by the jury. If the jury doesn't give that any weight, then they do that. But that's a fact issue as far as what their damages are. So that would be where I'd start. But to go further in that and look at the case law, the very first response from the hotel is go get checked. I mean, you had these little kids that were playing with, and one of the kids put the condom in her mouth, and go get checked. That was in the direct result of what took place. When you look at the Couliard case, I mean, that looks at, you know, malpractice that comes up part after the fact. And I'd submit that Minnesota case law does weigh heavily in favor of the appellant in making a connection. They never would have had these shots. They never would have had the false negative. This wouldn't have happened except for this event. They didn't plan to go do these things. even the argument that, well, they had some pre-existing injuries goes more towards an eggshell skull type position. And again, goes to weight and how a jury would weigh that versus a legal decision determined you don't have a right to go to court at all.
Does that answer your question, or I don't want to interrupt that?
Well, no, go ahead and feel free to interrupt. I'm sure we'll go back and, I mean, I'm not totally satisfied about the completion of the answer, but I'll leave it to Mr. Bryan to weave into his answer a response to your question, which I'm gathering is a follow-up.
No, it actually takes us in a slightly different direction. So, I mean, my question is, backing up, what are your claims in this case? I mean, it's negligent infliction of emotional distress. And then in your complaint, I see a negligent hiring, training, and supervision claim, but I don't see that was ever, I mean, you submitted no evidence on that in response to a summary judgment motion. So are we just dealing with negligent infliction of emotional distress as your claim?
Well, that would go towards the issue of they had an employee that did this. And I think the court accepted that they did have a duty to the individual that to my clients. So I guess I didn't see that I thought that was handled by the court.
So it's just kind of a plain old negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Correct. They had the harm. They had the harm mm-hmm. for, you know, yeah. the scary thing that happened, but the actual beyond that, the harm was getting the injections, having to go through being held down in order to go through the injections, getting a false positive on the HIV for a couple of days, the parents thought that one of their kids had HIV. And beyond that, just going through the trauma of this event, that's right. What our damages are based upon.
Right. So can I back you up then a little earlier in that analysis? Because the court does address this issue, and I don't see anything that says KAC versus Benson is not good law anymore in the state of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, you know, if you question that, I mean, let me know. But under that case, how can any of the plaintiffs in this case actually be within the zone of danger under that case? And then as a subset of that, let's first start with that question. So how are they within the zone of danger when there's no evidence that there were actually any infectious agents in the condom?
Well, but they don't know that at the time.
But that's the whole thing that's the whole holding in KAC. So how do you distinguish that and why would you say the analysis shouldn't begin and end with that case?
Well, because it goes beyond that. They had the physical damage of having to go through getting shots. They had to go through getting
tests. That doesn't create, so you're saying the fact they had to get a shot put them, the zone of danger was that they would have to go and get a shot. Is that your argument?
Oh, I apologize. The zone of danger is that the condom was left. The negligence, the act itself was that the condom was there and that the one kid or they were playing with it and the kid put it in her mouth. That's I've always understood zone of danger as being the actual act that causes whatever comes out of it. So
in KAC, this is a quote from KAC. We hold that a plaintiff who fails to allege actual exposure, in this case, it was HIV, but in a condom, presumably if it's a used condom, there could be any number of infectious agents, is not as a matter of law in personal physical danger of contracting HIV and thus not within a zone of danger for purposes of establishing a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress. And so how do we get around that holding in that case, which seems to be kind of the, at least if we're looking at the zone of danger part of it, and I get your argument on Couillard with respect to, you know, saying, well, the needle stick, you know, having to have blood drawn, that still can be, you know, in the course And I understand your argument on that, but help us deal with that holding in KAC.
Well, let me think for a second. I guess for me, it's clear. And so I'm trying to articulate this in a way that comes across. I mean, they presupposed that there's no way these kids could have had HIV. We have a false negative for a time period that they think they have HIV, and they get tested for HIV because of what's happened. I mean, we know that it's a used condom. You don't know, it doesn't come, you don't even know whose condom it is. You don't know who was involved in the back and forth. I think all of those things are different than a case where there's more of a consent or there's more of a understanding of what's taking place versus little kids who think they got a balloon and put this in their mouth under the balloon. I mean, the little kid didn't put the condom in her mouth knowing it was a condom because she had no idea what a condom was at the time. So I think that there's facts in this case that are different, but if in the end, I think that the needle stick and the having to go through what the kids had to go through is enough to get us forward to go to a jury and for a jury to weigh the damages.
Okay. And then, so then also help me with the parents' claim, because the parents suffered no physical injury. So
we didn't appeal the parents' claim.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Thanks for that clarification.
The parents' claim is only
overlooking that.
Oh, excuse me, Jeff.
Okay. No. Okay. All right. Thanks for that clarification. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Parents' claim is only derivative of the children's claim for what they have to pay as parents. We dropped the part of the case for the parents. There's no consortium in Minnesota, and you know, we didn't go forward with that. So that's why we didn't even address that in our brief.
Okay. I'm sorry. That's probably knew that when I first reviewed the case, but at any rate, thank you so much for that clarification.
I don't think we said we dropped it, but we didn't. That's not even one of our appealable issues or our appellate issues. So that's I probably should have addressed that we're not even bothering about that.
Mr. Bryant, just another clarification. Do you have a separate claim for physical injury, or is the physical injury part of the emotional distress claim?
Well, physical injury, I think, is one of the elements of the zone of danger, which is why we argue it the way we do. But I think in the end, we have a physical injury claim that should be weighed by a jury. So I think the answer is both, would be my answer on that.
Did you plead a physical injury claim or just an emotional distress claim?
I believe we pled a physical claim for the negligence directly. I'd have to look to be sure. And I assume that's part of the record. I think our complaint's part of the record. So, but I believe we did. Anything else? And Judge Ross, you had a, did I answer your question or did you have something?
Well, I think you were in the process of answering and explaining why it is you feel that this case fits that body of cases where it's not too attenuated for the court to decide as a matter of law at summary judgment that there's not a close enough relationship between the alleged breach and the injury.
Yeah. And I guess my position would be that Couliard covers it, that's a natural consequence, that the testing's a natural consequence. That's about the only thing you can do to figure out. I mean, it's like a physical examination. And unfortunately, that was traumatic for the one child because of a pre-existing condition. But beyond that, what came up with the false positive for a couple of days. So I'd submit that case law does support us and allows us to go forward with the jury. And that anything else goes more towards weight. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Emily Ewell. I represent the respondent, Stan Hospitality, LLC. To answer Judge Ross's question about is this claim too far attenuated between the breach and incident? It's respondent's position that it is. And that's one reason the district court properly affirmed and granted summary judgment on this basis. To answer Judge Siegel's question about whether or not KAC is still good law, that answer is it is. It's our position that the court properly applied dismissal through the negligent infliction of emotional distress standard under the KAC v. Benson, because for the first position, there was no actual exposure established. And you cannot get around that in this case, even though the facts are different. This still applies. I'll go further in depth into that as well. And then our third position.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead and make your, I have a question. Okay. Go ahead with your.
Okay. Our third position as it relates to whether or not there's a physical injury or that's separate or distinct from the zone of danger. It's our position that the entire claim of the appellants should be looked through the zone of danger standard. And that there is not a separate physical injury, because what they're claiming is not a physical injury that is contemporaneous to the event, but because what they're alleging is a subsequent injury that's subsequent to the event, that the court properly reviews it under the zone of danger standard.
So my question is, what case or cases do you feel most strongly supports your argument as to the scenario being too attenuated to survive summary judgment?
I believe in this type of case that, you know, there's case law that really KAC v. Benson for the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. Then the research I found, Your Honors, I could not find anything where a court has granted or a court has allowed for a claim of physical injury arising from diagnostic testing itself.
Right, but is there a case that you think you found either in Minnesota or elsewhere on the question of the attenuated nature of the injury as it relates to the cause? Have you found a case that, what case have you found that you think is strongest in support of affirming the district court on the issue of attenuation?
Your Honor, give me a second to look through my notes, if that's okay.
That's fine. I don't want you to use up all of your time looking. Okay. If it's not fresh on your mind, you can. And I'm getting some body language that Judge Siegel has a question that may take us in a different course. So I don't want you to lose all of your time looking for a case if it's not fresh in your mind.
No, I would just have my hand on my chin. I was trying to look very judicial. But so my question to you is, we've got KAC, you know, back to the zone of danger issue. But that was decided in 1990, whatever, five or four. You know, there was a policy reason, it seems to me, behind it, and kind of protecting people who were HIV positive, as there was no real risk of just being close to that individual, you know, that you would contract HIV. Here we have a condom, and then, you know, at summary judgment, we have to assume that it was the employee of your client who put that used condom there, and these kids were playing with it. So why isn't it sort of like a negligence per se? I mean, we all know that there's risk from transmission of bodily fluids. You know, these are these kids, they're vulnerable kids on top of that. I mean, why should we parse so closely, this zone of danger argument? I mean, but everybody admits there was a duty owed here by your client. You know, they were staying in the hotel, and that duty was breached. So help me out there. Help us out.
Okay, Your Honor. One of the issues and one of the issues we briefed on wasn't the fact that there was a duty. One of the arguments that we preserved upon appeal was the issue of breach. And we believe that the district court got that wrong because, again, at the time of the incident, it can't be negligence per se, because when you talk about negligence per se or res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. You're talking about case law that establishes pure custody, control, maintenance, or custody of that area. So in this case, we're dealing with a hotel room in which this was the fourth day of appellant's stay. Not only did appellants, their two children and a teenage child, stay in that premise, but there were also a dog and cat. The dog came inside, outside, and again, it was not clear custody. Based on our briefing and materials, we argued that there wasn't a breach based, and that the court erred on this and used the supposition of the case law of E.H. Renner and Sons when there's multiple inferences. That doesn't substantiate and support plaintiff's claim on that specific standard.
Is that under a summary judgment, though? I mean, don't we have to assume that with any disputed fact that the plaintiff's version is the correct one on for purposes of summary judgment?
Not when it comes to if there's more than one inference that's equally likely. And there aren't any facts here. Again, plaintiffs on the record advise that they don't know how the condom got there. They don't know what time frame it was there or how long it was there. It's purely speculative that, again.
But doesn't their testimony rule out that they put it there?
The testimony of Kevin and Julie Kopka is that neither Kevin or Julie Kopka put it there.
Right. So if we accept that as true for the purpose of summary judgment, then I'm trying to get a sense of why you believe that there's a basis to go forward with the idea that it wasn't negligent to have left it there when by hotel staff. I'm not saying the hotel staff put it there, but
I'm going on the basis that there's not enough facts and evidence to support the proposition that our staff left it there. Wait a minute.
So the evidence in the record, though, from like Mr. and Mrs. Kopka is that she was in the room, no condom. They were all out of the room. Housekeeper comes in. And then when she comes back in the room, there's a condom there. I mean, so isn't, how is that not the facts that we're supposed to assume for purposes of summary judgment? Or is there just a genuine issue of material fact on that question?
There isn't a genuine issue of material fact because, again, the facts establish that, again, it's presupposing the area where it was located was an area that the employee was in. The facts also establish that the hotel keeper brought in linens and new towels. And that was in the bedrooms and bathrooms, not the area that the children were in when they discovered the condom. But going back to your question on infectious disease.
I don't want to hold you up too much here because I think you have a more substantive argument on what you're about to get to. I'm just sort of struggling with the idea that there's not enough. We're just talking about a preponderance of the evidence standard. And so if there's testimony that we were in the room, no condom. Housekeeping staff comes in. Housekeeping staff leaves. We come back in the room, condom was there. I'm at a loss as to why, at least on the simple preponderance of the evidence standard, there's not enough for us to say there's a disputed issue of material fact. A jury could indeed find that, regardless of the testimony of the housekeeper, that the housekeeper was responsible for leaving the condom in the room.
I think
you probably have a stronger argument on the law, so I don't want to spend all of our time.
Okay. So, switching over to the substantive question about the actual exposure. in regards to Judge Siegel's question. KAC still applies because there still has to be an objective application. And again, you know, we're talking about actual exposure, and the court doesn't just address the first prong of actual exposure. The court addresses the second prong as well about reasonable fear. And the children admit that, you know, they don't know about the, you know, they don't know about AIDS, infectious disease, never were told why they were treated or tested, excuse me. And they never had any memories related to the incident or held any memories related to the discovery of the condom itself. As it relates to the specific question about, you know, we're talking about a condom. We have our infectious disease report that says, again, that creates similar to KAC, the fact that just touching a condom, holding a condom, the likelihood again, does not create actual exposure. And that's the standard here is, and the standard is still good law, that we're still talking actual exposure in some sort of event. Now, when counsel's arguing about the physical injury and the physical injury, again, on the record, and the record is clear that they're arguing the physical injury results from the blood draws or blood tests, we have clear case law there that in Langland, the Farmers State Bank, that in any case where physical symptoms subsequent to and because of the plaintiff's emotional disturbance, many jurisdictions, including this one, require the plaintiff to have been in some personal physical danger caused by the defendant's negligence.
So your arguments seem to be very focused on the emotional distress argument, but in looking at the plaintiff's complaint in this case, they alleged pain and essentially physical injury separate and apart from any mental injury. And I'm wondering if the arguments that you're making and the KAC case that we're discussing would apply to preclude those claims.
Yes. And my answer is yes, because the under LICTIG, there's three ways for emotional distress or physical injury, emotional distress claims, which I believe this is what plaintiffs claiming or appellants are claiming to provide in tort. You've got one, a contemporaneous physical injury. You have two, the negligent infliction of emotional distress. And you have three, willful or wanton conduct. Case law is clear that for a physical injury claim to prevail for emotional distress, there has to be a contemporaneous injury. Otherwise, this type of physical injury, the type that the appellants are claiming, all fall under the KAC zone of danger test. And then, for example, the unpublished case of Dillard v. Targeson in 2006, a U.S. District Court of Minnesota case, that was a case where the plaintiff stepped on a hypodermic needle, also punctured her toe, and then subsequently punctured her finger. And in that case, the plaintiffs claimed a physical injury. In that case as well, the district court dismissed that claim, again, finding that there was no actual exposure or proof that the needle was contaminated or contained a communicable disease. They also didn't believe the physical injury claim applied under the other two standards, noting it was a parasitic damage.
Of course, whether it's federal or state, district court decisions are certainly not binding on our court's interpretation of state law.
Yes, and appellant's counsel just had a case, Gross v. Prestige, July 2016, A 2016-35, where they claimed that appellant suffered a physical injury. And the court again said, unless the person claiming emotional distress damages suffered a contemporaneous physical injury, that case still falls under the zone of danger.
Thank you. Well, that was a last minute punch. I'm sure Mr. Bryant's ready to respond to that one, but Nicely done. Counsel for appellant, you have the floor for rebuttal, if you like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things. I would submit that the information on LATIG or LITIG goes more towards weight. And again, it's a weighting issue as far as the damages that were suffered. And that's something to be decided by a jury. Second, on KC, we're not claiming that that's bad law or that that needs to be replaced. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that the facts are different enough from that. I mean, even if you look at-
Well, sort of. You seem to be sort of saying that when you challenge the doctrine of zone of danger on its face. I thought that was an argument in your brief.
Well, yeah, sure, but the facts different is, I mean, with that case, you know, you're making an argument about HIV because of you know what's involved, you know who's involved, you know what parts are involved. Like in Dillard, the court looked at the issue of the needle and said you can't prove that needle was, you know, whatever that needle was. You can't prove that it was a this type of needle or that type of needle. Here we've got a used condom. You're not going to give kids a used condom to play with or tell them to put it in their mouth. That's just not going to happen. And so we clearly know just from it being a used condom, we know certain things about it. We just don't know who was involved. The kids weren't involved in the creation of the used condom or however it became used. But we know that we've got parts with it and fluids with it that are all scary issues. And because of that, I'd submit that's what gives us the claim to go forward. Thank you, Judge, for I'm sorry I didn't have the complaint with me, but on the issue of what we alleged as far as the complaint goes, and that was different. That was one of the big differences in the Gross case that was brought up at the end. Gross, well, I don't think Gross has a lot to do with this case. That was the one that I lost in the Court of Appeals recently concerning a zone of danger issue. But there wasn't the same type of issue in the Gross case, and there were other factors that I'd submit have nothing to do with this case. The last thing is this issue that we got into for a little bit in the respondent's argument about their claim that there was never a duty to begin with, and that they somehow appealed it. I don't think that it's in the right positional, the posture on how you deal with that kind of issue. I think they would have had to do a brief on that and had to do that earlier than they did. I think the court found that there was a duty, and based upon the finding of the duty, the facts are there, and it's not an issue before this court at this time. That's why we didn't address it further in our brief. And I don't think it's an appealable issue based upon its posturing. But going back to everything, I'd submit with what happened, with the connections as far as how the condom came into play, with what happened with the kids having the condom and playing with the condom, and then the results from that, if you look at Couillard, I'd submit we have enough here that we should be able to go to a jury and let a jury weigh in on whether or not, you know, there was real damages or whether or not there was a real injury beyond that. So
that's, well, before you close your argument, I wanted you to go back one more time on the issue that Judge Siegel brought up. And I'm just, you've accepted the KAC is still good law, and it does impose, it seemed to be a pretty clear standard. Again, a plaintiff who fails to allege an actual exposure to HIV is not, as a matter of law, in personal physical danger of contracting HIV and thus not within the zone of danger for either purposes of a claim of not for a claim of negligent infliction of emotional distress. So I'm still struggling with whether your response as a matter of fact gets over that, because you seem to suggest, well, there are different facts involved in, you know, whether you have a needle or versus a condom. It seems to be a pretty clear standard of law, and I'm not sure I see any room for the distinction you're asking us to make.
If that's the way it's seen, Your Honor, then we lose on that.
Just threw that out there as an opportunity for you to disabuse me of my
sure
assumption. I wasn't asking you to surrender to me.
No, I wasn't surrendering. I was just saying accepting that to me, there's a clear distinction between. You go through an interaction, you go through whatever takes place, an adult goes through what takes place and then alleges, I have this fear because of this. And these kids who put a used condom in their, or one of the kids put a used condom in their mouth and played with the used condom, they have no idea when the mom comes out and the kids are playing with it, nobody has any idea what created the used condom. We know because it's a used condom, we can accept, and I'd submit that it's part of the evidence that because it's a used condom, we know that there's sperm in it. We know that there's some exchange. We don't know who created it. One person created it, two people, five people. We don't know that. We don't have any of the same factors or the same knowledge that takes place. Then the very first respondent from the defendant is go get them tested. They go get them tested. And the first response from that test is the false positive. So they believe she potentially got it at that point. So I think for all of those reasons, there's a distinction there in the facts that we don't lose based upon that case law.
Well, thank you. Thank you to both counsel. I'm sorry, Judge Siegel.
Can I just, so there's no evidence any place in the record that there actually were bodily fluid in the condom, correct? I mean, it's referred to as a used condom, but I mean, I just wanted to make sure I understand the record.
I've always understood it as being a used condom, and I've always accepted that to be the case. That as part of being a used condom, it was used as a used condom. Right. I mean, we don't know beyond that how it became a used condom. So I would say that, but I think we know it's a used condom.
Well, it's referred to as a used condom, and there's nothing more than, got it. Okay, thanks, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you. And again, thank you for moving this on the, I know that's a very rare occasion. Thank you.
Well, I hope your knee is better and you're back to ballet or whatever it is you do on your knee.
The surgery went fine, so we're in good shape. Thank you, Judge.
We appreciate your arguments, both of you, in brief and the oral argument today. The matter is submitted and we will take it under advisement, issue an opinion within our statutory period.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.